Hey, everybody. Welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We are your hosts, Vincent Hannum,
Matt Levine,
and we are talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Go ahead and follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in our bio.
Within the uncharted depths of waters surrounding a group of islands off the 50th parallel lies man's most formidable challenge. The awesome awakening of prehistoric monsters long thought extinct. Savage and deadly, their one hope is to rule our planet as they once had thousands of years back. Giant against giant. The ultimate battle. Godzilla versus Megalon. Science was baffled and powerless. A terror-stricken humanity knew that it was on the brink of total destruction. A once proud civilization now had to place its trust and hope in Godzilla and his powerful ally, Robot Man. In concert, they would fight this evil in a duel to the death. Battling by day, battling by night, it was more than a race against time. This war was an all-out effort whose ultimate purpose was to save our planet from total destruction. Now came the moment of truth. The ultimate battle. Titan against Titan. Giant against giant in the most spectacular battle yet. You'll see it all in Godzilla versus Megalon.
Well, everybody, we have a very special episode today, a very special guest. We are discussing Godzilla versus Megalon with Max Hannum, who is kind enough to pinch hit here for Matt, who is still taking a bit of personal time. Again, he's great. He's doing all right, but we look forward to his return as soon as he's ready. Hey, Max, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. How about you?
Not too shabby. This is a daytime recording. Usually Matt and I record at night, but I happen to have the day off. You do as well. Mm-hmm. So we're doing this at 12 o'clock, high noon.
It's at noon for you, you know.
Right. Where are you calling in from today?
Oh, I'm in the beautiful Pacific Northwest.
Ooh, how beautiful is it this summer?
It's pretty hot. still beautiful. Like, I was up at 4 o'clock this morning just because the house was hot. So I woke up to get like a glass of water from the kitchen. And I was just looking out the window. The sun was rising, beautiful pink sky, mountains in the background. Absolutely beautiful.
Okay, well, I'm jealous. The view from my backyard beyond the fence is an alley with some trash cans and squirrels doing God knows what in the trees. I don't know. They're like really chatty this morning, just chasing each other around.
That's sort of fun.
Who knows? For those of you listening, we are dropping this episode on August 10th. So if this is August 10th, I don't know. I just thought the date would be helpful because me and Max are going to talk about upcoming releases and other bits of news. So if you're listening to this far in the future, just know timing is important here. Max, I want to share with you some interesting feedback we got from your last episode with Camp Kaiju, which was the Cold Skin episode.
Ooh, I'd love some feedback.
Yeah, well, we posted a poll through the podcast. So listeners, wherever you're listening to your podcast, if it's on Spotify especially, look for a poll that will accompany each new episode. And this poll was, let me pull it up, which franchise should Max cover on Camp Kaiju? Because if you recall, Max, we talked about a potential new series where you deep dive into a franchise.
Right, yeah.
So to the listeners, I threw out some options. We have Hellraiser and Bergman, The Scorpion King, Tremors, or The Howling. So we had two voters. Thank you for voting. We appreciate the participation there. But it was a tie. So we had one vote for Hellraiser and Bergman and one vote for the Howling franchise.
Well, how many movies are in the Howling franchise?
Let me look that one up. But since it is a tie, I don't think you're committed to either one right now. I think it's dealer's choice.
You know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the Howling franchise pales in comparison to 40-something Bergman films and then the, 10 or 11 Hellraiser movies. So that one is a little bit more manageable to start.
Hey, I'm okay with that. Let's do it. I've only seen the first Howling, but there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 entries in the franchise.
Oh, it's more than I thought there would be.
Yeah, same. From 1981 to 2011.
Oh, there's going to be some bad ones, aren't there?
Yeah, we have titles like Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, Howling 3, The Marsupials, Howling 6, The Freaks, and then the last one is The Howling Reborn.
It's like the same time period as Hellraiser. And I know the depths that Hellraiser went through.
Is Clive Turner related to Clive Barker? No, that's not how names work. Never mind.
Forget that. It's not.
Okay. Well,
I haven't seen any of them, so that would be interesting. Ooh. Get a fresh take.
You should watch the first one.
Not the third one?
The Marsupials?
Yeah. I've been to Australia.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Yeah, it does take place in Australia. Okay. It's not a Max episode without mentioning Hellraiser, at least.
Yeah, it seems to be a theme.
Okay, but what we're here today to discuss is Godzilla versus Megalon. And before I get to that, I just got to say thank you to all of our listeners for hanging out. Please rate and review this podcast wherever you listen. That is the best way to spread the word of this show. Our numbers are really good. They've always been tracking up in the 3 years we've been recording Camp Kaiju, but hey, we're ambitious here. We want to expand our reach, pull in new listeners, new friends, and your help goes a long way with that. You can send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com, our Facebook page, or our Instagram, and we'll feature those on the show. Or if you'd like your voice, your actual voice, featured on the show, like you're one of the hosts, you can leave us a voicemail at 612-470-2612. Just tell us about your favorite monster movies, and we'll feature that on the show. You can check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more reviews and special content. You can get sweet merch at campkaiju.threadless.com. And if all that isn't enough, go ahead and become a Patreon at patreon.com/campkaiju. for discounts, priority comments, and access to any live events. And we want to thank our patrons, Jason, Chris, Sean, our anonymous patron, and Peggy for your support. All right. Since last time, our last episode was King Kong versus Godzilla and our trivia with Naomi. But since then, we have some news in the Kaijuverse. So the next Monsterverse film is now slated for a 2027 release. Max, are you in hot anticipation for the next installment of the Godzilla and Kong adventures?
I need to see the latest installment.
Mm.
Because I saw the one from a couple of years ago. That was great. Enjoyed it. Fun time. But I haven't seen the latest one.
Well, I think it is.
So I want to see how the quality.
Yeah.
Is it still fun or is it just a, I don't know, cashing in on the success of the previous ones?
Totally. I think both. I think that's okay. It could be a bit of a cash grab, but still be fun. I think it's marginally better than Godzilla versus Kong.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that's good then. Because I had a fun time with the last one. So I know I saw the posters all like 4th of July themed and whatnot. And that was, I don't know, it kind of reminded me of the promotional material for Godzilla versus Megalon.
Well, yeah. So the new, which is keeping in line with the overall vibes of the MonsterVerse movies, which really lean into the Showa era camp and just big dumb fun.
Yeah. And I think that's why ultimately, yes, I am excited, but I'm holding my excitement in check because I don't want to overhype something in my mind and then it'd be a letdown.
Yes, I agree with that. Although I feel like even the worst Godzilla movie is still great. Like, I still want to watch that.
Mm.
Because there's so many bad, I mean, bad's a strong word. There are so many less than entries in the franchise.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can say bad, but bad doesn't mean you can't enjoy it.
Yeah. Some people think Godzilla versus Megalon is one of the worst movies in the franchise.
Well, I mean, if you want to get into it, we can get into it now.
No. We'll hold off.
All right. We'll get back to that. I'll hold my thoughts.
Okay. Hold your thoughts. So, Max, if you want to watch Godzilla Kong, The New Empire, it is streaming on Max at this time.
Hmm.
So have at it. And then this week in Monster Movie History, for the first 2 weeks of August, we have some movies celebrating some anniversaries. Any titles there jump out at you?
The Blob.
Yeah, the 1988 Blob was released in August of that year.
I watched that for the first time about 6 months ago.
Ooh.
Absolutely loved it.
Yeah, right?
It was way better than I thought it would be. And love the effects. Like, I love that era in film history where it was like pretty much the peak of practical effects only a few years before all the digital effects started coming into play. So, I don't know. It's just so visceral.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah. It is a movie that I have touched on briefly on Camp Kaiju, but it deserves its own full length episode.
Sure. One
day. Yeah. I'd love to do that. We talked about the 58 Blob last season, which is great in its own way. But like you say, the 80s were peak practical effects.
Yes.
Yeah. Other films released in August in history. Kaiju films. We have Space Amoeba from 1970, directed by Ishiro Honda. We have Frankenstein Conquers the World from 1965, another Honda film. Those movies, Max, Space Amoeba and Frankenstein Conquers the World, compare and contrast. Space Amoeba is one of those movies I would say is a quote-unquote bad kaiju film, but Frankenstein Conquers the World, I hold in high regard. It is one of the best kaiju films I've ever seen.
Hmm.
So check those ones out.
Yeah, I haven't seen Frankenstein Conquers the World. So I'll have to check that out.
A rocket ship to unexplored planets, captured by unknown powers. Yogg, monster from space. Powerless against me. An irresistible, terrorizing monster. have merged ourselves into the giant crab and the jungle turtle. The unconquerable. The unbelievable. Yogg, monster from space.
From the ocean's unfathomable depths, a gigantic, man-like creature appears. Fiery depths of the earth comes a prehistoric mastodon of destruction. Never before has the screen known such heart-stopping terror. Starring Nick Adams.
Well, I feel he's very important from a scientific point of view.
I'd have to cut off a leg or an arm.
Doctors, I won't let you conduct this test.
Frankenstein. With the strength of 1,000 men. And every man's need for affection that makes him a willing captive.
The chain hurts you.
The new scoop of the century. The horrifying touch of a severed hand with a life of its own. Terrifying force of a monster that dwarfs man's tallest structures.
Bringing us up to speed in the year 2024, we have some upcoming releases. Alien Romulus comes out next week on August 16th. We have a trailer for Nosferatu, Robert Eggers. And we have Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, the sequel to Tim Burton's really beloved film, coming out next month.
So you know how I was reserved for the new like MonsterVerse movie that like for 2027? I'm the exact opposite for Nosferatu and Alien.
You're on board 100%.
Yes. I'm not saying all the Alien movies are great, but I have thoroughly enjoyed the newer ones that have been released, mostly because it almost like pared down and simplified things. Because by the time you got to like the fourth Alien film, it was just getting really bloated, I felt like. And I'm glad they've gotten away from Ripley as a character.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I enjoyed that character and her journey, but I just felt like we were retreading ground.
Yeah, right.
So with this newer stuff, they're going different direction. Quality is hit or miss for people, but I just enjoy some nice, simple, like slasher-esque alien action.
Yeah, like a return to basics. This is a horror movie. It's a like the original is a horror movie. You said the word slasher. I think that's apt. The film is directed by... Or sorry, Romulus is directed by Fede Alvarez, who did the Evil Dead remake in the past decade.
Oh, I love that one.
Right. So I think Alvarez has an eye for the genre and like how to...
Yeah. I mean, what I loved about that Evil Dead remake was it was a serious horror movie, if that makes sense. But it still felt like it was connected to the franchise. So if he could do anything remotely as good as that Evil Dead remake,
yeah,
then it should be a home run.
I think people are hyped for it. Okay, coming up on Camp Kaiju, we have The Mummy. That will be our next episode, the 1999 version. And we're going to have Naomi Osborn back with some trivia for you all. Later on this episode, we will reveal the trivia winners for King Kong versus Godzilla. So thank you all for participating in that. Max, you will be back for The Mummy.
I almost watched The Mummy's Hand like 2 days ago.
Oh.
We switched and watched Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh. I do love The Mummy's Hand, but I was really just kind of
I don't know. I was just really impressed by Bram Stoker's Dracula. I think Coppola does like some really interesting things
that there's I wasn't expecting. A lot of great stuff in that movie. A lot of not so great stuff. Overall, good movie.
Yeah, it's like, oh, wow, cool.
It's like, this is great. Oh, this is bad.
Right. And then in September, we're going to talk about the film Possession, which Matt had said in our season preview is a, quote, hard R film. So watch with the lights on, I'm sure. But then we're going to bring Planet of the Apes, the 2001 version, which is not scary and kind of dumb, but I think it's worth looking into.
Is it, though?
No. But on Camp Kaiju, got to talk about the good, the bad, and the campy.
Well, you know, I was pleasantly surprised. I did a similar thing with AVP.
Oh, yeah.
I was pleasantly surprised at my reaction to rewatching that movie.
Yeah.
So
you never know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But let's talk about Godzilla versus Megalon, which a lot of people do call a bad movie, but we're here to see it in a maybe different light, maybe talk about it a little bit more critically. Maybe there are things going on beneath the surface that, you know, when you look past all the mess, you can see some glimmers of talent and choices. And you're like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing here. Max, what's your personal history with this film?
Well, this is the Godzilla film that we both grew up on.
Indeed.
We had a tape of it, watched it over and over.
Mm-hmm.
So I was having flashbacks to those younger years while watching it.
Mm-hmm.
From the very first image of the boy in that ridiculous boat thing at the very beginning.
It's so, yeah, like, what is that thing he's on?
It's so inefficient. Like, I don't know if it was an actual product or they just made it for the film, but yeah. It wasn't doing anything.
Like, how do you even get out there on that lake? Did they just drop him and say good luck?
Right. Did they just push him off and he just floated out there? Or was it an actual product that works, but they, for filming purposes, just, I don't know, anchored him? I don't know. Very weird. But I've got a lot of nostalgia for this movie that, yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people do.
Right, which we'll get into. The availability of this film was widespread in the States.
Right.
Had you seen it since you were a kid?
No. I've watched clips of the final fight since I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't seen the whole movie. So in reality, I was kind of watching it for the first time as far as, like, I don't know, paying attention to the story or characters or anything.
That's awesome. Did you watch the sub or the dub version?
Ooh, see, I watched the Criterion Blu-ray.
Same.
And I thought I set it to the Japanese audio with English subtitles, but I think what I did was I turned it to the English audio and no subtitles because that's what played. And once it started, I was like, well, I'm here now. And since that's the version I grew up watching, I decided to just let it ride.
I think that's okay. I did some research. There are no discernible differences. The minor differences. Well, I don't know. So there's the US release, which cut 3 minutes, but on this Blu-ray, on the Criterion, I watched the Japanese language version, and then I kind of like watched bits and pieces of the English language version just to see if there were any difference in the cuts and the editing. There were no differences that I could tell on the Criterion DVD. Now, if I watch this old VHS that I have, that might be where you see the cuts.
Yeah, I did watch that version of it because I found it online. And it was, well, that website claimed it was in the public domain, which it's not.
Right.
Which is why it was on there. But I did watch it just to see how they cut things out. It's all mostly with that truck scene where you can see some like nude pinups.
Yeah, which I do not ever remember. So I think, right, the VHS we grew up watching cut the nude pinups and there was some mild swearing that was cut from the US release as well.
Yeah. So I did watch that edited version just to see how they changed it, because I didn't really remember. Mm-hmm. And that whole scene is just cut, and it's just the last line.
Oh, interesting.
Of, well, I guess it's none of our business what we are doing with this crate and why we're dumping it in the lake. That's it.
Ah, that's so indicative of like the entire script, though, where it's just like, oh, well, we have this giant robot, or we have Jet Jaguar, but like, we don't know why they built Jet Jaguar. We don't know where this funding comes from. Like, we know nothing about anything, really.
Any characters.
It's all very surface level.
Right. Like, you read the synopsis or the character descriptions, and none of that's in the actual movie.
That's true.
All right, so the two main characters, or three main characters. You've got these two adult men and a small boy.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, it was like, okay, they're friends, and I couldn't remember where the kid fell into it. But the description of the characters are, yeah, they're two friends, and the boy is the younger brother of one of them.
Right.
It's not even in the movie, unless I missed it, but...
It's halfway through the movie. It's mentioned that Rokuro, the little boy, is the kid brother of Goro.
Oh,
yeah.
Must have missed it.
But like, I wrote a note like, what is their relationship? And then halfway through, it was revealed to me. I was like, oh, okay. That would have been nice to know at the start of the film.
Yeah. I mean, the whole script is like that, where there's just details missing or are vague, but you kind of get what's going on, but it leaves a lot to the viewer to just make a decision on what's going on.
Which, that's a really interesting point. Let's put a pin in that. Let's talk about the cast and crew, which we're already kind of doing a little bit. But then I want to read the brief synopsis of this film from the VHS that we had. It's from, what's this called? Burbank Video. It's the edition where Godzilla and Megalon are fighting atop the Twin Towers. Which totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. So on the back of this, it says, the most enjoyable of this now classic series, Godzilla and a robot are the superheroes, while Megalon and his companion Gigan are the supervillains. This film is also notable for the Cetopians, an underwater race who do battle with the monsters. Angered by recent nuclear tests, the ruler of an underwater world sends a monster to destroy Tokyo. Godzilla once again proves that evil cannot prevail in this clash with supervillain Megalon. Okay, that took a little liberties with the story, but that's basically what happens.
I mean, that's pretty much the entire written script right there.
Yep, Fukuda gave his cast that synopsis and said, just improvise everything. We got this.
All right, this is the scene where you send Megalon out. Oh, okay.
Not far from the truth, but yep. Who is Fukuda, and who are some of the talent behind the screen, behind the camera on this movie?
So this is his fourth Godzilla film. He's directed five total in the Showa era, including the previous Godzilla versus Gigan and the subsequent Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. He was a contract director who helmed a number of crime films for Toho in the 60s.
Yeah. The film was produced by Tomoyuki Tanaka, of course, who did every film in the franchise, essentially. Well, up until the 90s. And then this is where we get into some of that difference between story and script. So the story is by Shinichi Sekizawa. He penned a number of Godzilla films and kaiju films in the 60s. He had a reputation for lighter scripts, but... The prep for this movie was really rushed. So Sekizawa only had the story, and he said to Fukuda, you take the screenplay because I am out of time. I can't write this. So Fukuda hastily wrote the screenplay for this movie.
You could tell this was a very pared down production. Things are shot very flatly, it seems. It's just, hey, stand over there. We're just going to have the camera here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few scenes where it's much more dynamic, but you can tell when it's like, just stand on top of the hill over there. Okay.
Right, right.
One of the more fun scenes in the movie is the car chase. And it's fun because it starts getting really ridiculous towards the end.
Yeah.
Like they're going down an impossibly steep hill. It's like, is there someone actually driving that car down that hill? Because kudos to whoever that driver was.
Oh, yeah. I have notes about that car chase.
Screeching tires on dirt.
Yep. Like, what? That's what I mean. Like, there's...
You see the cars go down that hill or do some stuff, and then after all that, you see the motorcycle pop up again because they weren't going to have the motorcycle
right
do that same thing.
That car chase is an example of what I think... Ultimately, this movie, to me, is not a bad movie so much as it is a purely campy movie. Because those kinds of choices, you could say, are bad, but they actually, I think, enhance the enjoyment of the film. They don't distract, really.
Right. And to me, it's a lot of the problems I have are from it being constrained with the production realities of it.
Exactly. Right. And we'll get into the production history in a little bit.
Right.
Music by Rishiro Manabe, who also did the music for Godzilla versus Hedorah. We have special effects by a man named Teruyoshi Nakano, who took over the special effects department at Toho after Tsuburaya died in 1970. So all this to say is we have the Showa era, but we have two eras within the Showa era. We have the 50s and 60s, which was Honda, Ifukube, Tsuburaya. And then in the 70s, those guys are out of the picture more or less. And we have a new director. We have a new visual effects director. We have a new composer. And I think when we talk about the 70s Godzilla movies, the general consensus is that these movies are lesser than, that they are very cheap and rough around the edges. So I don't know what that says about the talent behind the camera, but
it's probably more to do with the studio politics of it and less to do with the abilities of all of those involved, because you can only do so much if you're not getting the support you need. Because if you only have 3 weeks to shoot, yeah, obviously they're going to rely on all that stock footage that they had accrued.
Yeah, so this is directly related to where we're at in Japanese cinema in the 1970s. It was not the preferred media for adult film goers. TV was, and especially with the tokusatsu genre, you look at Gamera, you look at Godzilla on the big screen, but then you had TV shows like Ultraman and Zone Fighter. This kaiju cinema was definitely a kids genre at this point.
Right. And this, I mean, with the very prominent child protagonist.
Exactly.
You can see where their minds were at. Kid orientated productions, you know, it might be like hand waved of, oh, that doesn't matter. Kids don't care about that.
Which, that's a really interesting point about movies made for children. I think you can do that really well and smartly. And, you know, there's lots of examples of smart kid movies with emotional depth and heart.
And quality.
And quality. And then you have movies that just completely talk down to their audience. And I don't know. First of all, as an adult, I hate those movies. And then if I was a kid, I'm like, I don't know, give the kids more credit.
Those simpler movies that, you know, quality suffers because it's for kids. Children age out of that really quickly. So if you have a movie that is quality, that is also for kids, then, I don't know, a person can enjoy that movie longer.
Right. They grow up with it. It changes as they grow older.
Right. Because, I mean, when we were watching movies when we were kids, yeah, we watched kids' movies, sure. But then we were watching just adult movies by the time we were 10.
Right.
And that just shows that, you know, kids are interested in more than just stuff for kids.
Exactly.
You know, one of our favorite movies is Jaws. We were watching that. That's not a kid's movie.
But Spielberg, he does focus on children in that movie, which I think is he does in all of his movies. But like that's an example. That's a good example of, you know, as a child, there are still characters you might be able to relate to and a father figure and things right. within mean, that. Yeah.
Yeah. There's stuff that kids can attach to, but it also, I don't know. I mean, we were probably excited to be like, oh, we get to watch a real movie now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just feel like it's very short-sighted to just think of something as a product for kids and not give it the attention that it deserves.
Totally agree. We'll talk about kids more in a little bit. In real life, children were kind of central to a large part of this movie. But our quick cast, and it is a quick cast, there are 9 speaking roles, and I'm only going to give you like 4 or 5 of them. But there are no extras in this movie, which I didn't realize until after I watched it. I was like, oh yeah, like your cars are on barren streets. There are no cityscapes really. And that's just, again, indicative of this threadbare budget.
And I assume all the crowd scenes were reused footage?
I think so, in hindsight, yeah. 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 So we have Katsuhiko Sasaki. He plays Goro, who is an inventor. He invents and builds the Jet Jaguar character. Sasaki later appeared in Terror of Mechagodzilla, Biollante, King Ghidorah. He is a veteran of the franchise.
He's also got a long career.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in general.
Yeah. Like, he's one of the actors in this that I think his career's still going.
I think he does the voice dubbing for Japanese releases of a lot of American films.
Right. He does a lot of voice acting, anime, video games, and then, yeah, a lot of dubbing for Japanese audiences.
His kid brother is played by Hiroyuki Kawasa. The character's name is Rokuro. Kawasa was actually the kid protagonist in Godzilla vs. Hedorah from a couple years prior. Yutaka Hayashi plays Goro's friend and an ace race car driver named Jinkawa, Hiroshi Jinkawa. And then I think the true star of Godzilla vs. Megalon, American actor Robert Dunham. He plays Emperor Antonio of Seatopia.
This guy, I don't know, just go read his Wikipedia page. That's a life.
Yeah, that's where I pulled off this information. He had lived in Japan for 22 years. He was a Marine, but he was in other Toho films, kaiju films, Dagara, the Space Monster, and the Green Slime. But he's looking fabulous in this movie, in his toga.
Yeah, tights.
Body hair, his tattoos.
He's just a 70s man.
Emperor Antonio.
And what a name that is. Emperor Antonio. What?
And then another notable cast member is Shinji Takagi. He plays Godzilla, and this is the first film without Haruo Nakajima in the suit, which is notable. Okay, production backstory. We've already talked a lot about where Japanese cinema, where it was at this time. You could see this in the overall budget of Megalon. We have worn out rubber suits at this time. We have a reliance on stock footage, a minimal use of cityscapes. Megalon, the final kaiju battle takes place in an open field. Other films of this at this time played from the same rule book. But then the children, this is a really interesting component. So in 1971, Toho and Tsuburaya Productions sponsored a contest for children to design a new monster to be featured in the next Godzilla movie. And this kid, Masaaki Sano, he came up with the idea for Jet Jaguar. So there you go. If it looks like a children made him up, it's because one did.
You know, I like Jet Jaguar.
Who doesn't? Fight me on that. He's great.
He does kind of stand out. I don't know, when looking at all of the kaiju in Godzilla, he does have his own unique aesthetic, it seems like. almost like a different franchise, like wormed its way in. But it's not. It's not like a pre-existing thing, even though it kind of feels that way.
Well, it's because it is Toho also jumping on the Ultraman bandwagon.
Right. That's what I mean. And I think it is a nice character to have and to just be like, yeah, let's pull him out. But I don't know. It probably speaks to the threadbare aspect of the script. But when he's introduced, it's almost like he is a pre-existing character.
Right. There's no backstory. That's what I'm saying.
Like, there's no backstory. Like, oh, yeah, you know Jet Jaguar.
Who doesn't?
Right. I don't know. It's,
yeah,
it creates an interesting vibe that I don't know was intended, but it kind of works.
And I think Jet Jaguar and the character of Megalon have both grown in popularity since this movie's release. They haven't been featured in a whole... Well, they haven't been featured in a feature-length film since this movie. But they are very popular in the comics, in little short films. Godzilla Singular Point, the anime on Netflix. Jet Jaguar is a main character. So... Yeah. Much love for JJ there. All right. Now, the release and legacy of this film is wild.
It was mostly the U.S. marketing and release and popularity where, I don't know why, but Toho decided that this was going to be the movie that, like the Godzilla movie, they were going to heavily promote in the U.S. And they did, and it made a lot of money and became popular.
Very popular.
And it also had a huge popularity with in the home video market.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Why?
Why did it have such popularity in the home video market?
Oh, I don't know. Tell me.
Because it was thought to be in the public domain.
Oh, right. Yeah, I did come across that.
Yeah.
I did mention that earlier, where it was posted on a website for public domain works. And then there's a bunch of people in the comments of that being like, this isn't actually in the public domain.
But it wasn't until the 2000s when Toho got their act together and reined that in. Because, it was never in the public domain. It was always a derivative of the Toho's copyright. But in the American release, that little word copyright was not on the print.
Right. Which
therefore...
is actually important.
Right. But in this case, not needed, since it is a derivative of a copywritten work.
Yes, it was pre-existing.
Right.
But what also gained it a bunch of popularity was it appearing on Mystery Science Theater.
Exactly. Yeah. Consequently.
Yeah. I'm sure a lot of people are in the same situation of us, of having a lot of nostalgia for this movie. And it probably being a prominent Godzilla film in their memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like there is a silver lining to blatant disregard for creative laws and copyright.
Yeah.
One could argue.
Yeah. It was just, what we were mentioning about the cover with Godzilla Megalon, the US poster for it had them on the Twin Towers in New York, purely for promotional marketing. It's a great, great piece of art.
It is. It calls to mind the poster for the 1976 King Kong, which, yes, I definitely believe the Megalon distributors were capitalizing on there.
Mm-hmm.
There was also, this is so fascinating, this is going to be the only time John Belushi and Saturday Night Live is ever mentioned on this podcast. But NBC aired the film in prime time in 1977. And get this, they only had an hour time slot. So they cut the film down, an already 80 minute film. They cut it down to 48 minutes to accommodate commercials. But John Belushi hosted the program in a Godzilla suit. Man,
I would love to see that cut.
Totally.
Because it might be better.
With John Belushi in the program?
I mean, it's not going to hurt. Well, I mean, there's barely anything in this script, so there's probably a lot that can be cut out that doesn't matter. as far as the story goes. So it's, I don't think it's a travesty of an edit, probably.
No, not at all. I have looked into this NBC airing, and I don't think it exists. Like on message boards and things, people are sad that a copy of this program doesn't exist anymore. Because I would love to see John Belushi in this thing.
And that's a little bit before, you know, people had VCRs and could tape it.
Right, exactly. Just before, too.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so big legacy in the West. However, in Japan, it was a total box office bust. And it was actually the first Godzilla movie to sell less than 1 million tickets. So not popular. At least at the time. I don't know what it's like now. I know Jet Jaguar is very popular, so maybe there's some more love for this film in Japan.
Well, it could, and this is pure speculation, so let me know if I'm wrong. It could be anybody going back to watch it now might not recognize that there's a lot of reused footage, or they're watching it knowing that it's way more campy than, let's say, quality.
Yeah. Like, the frame of mind is so important, too, when you watch right. this. You have to know what you're getting into.
Exactly. Like, you're not going to go to Showa-era Godzilla movies and expect something from the 80s, you know?
Yep.
Like Heisei Godzilla.
Yep.
They pretty much all turned very campy.
Very quickly.
Yes.
Which is what the MonsterVerse is now doing. Started off very serious, and now it's... Yeah, it's
well, that's a much better change. Godzilla 2014. It was 2014, right?
Yeah.
That movie's hard to watch.
Well, I actually disagree, but let's save that conversation for another time.
Well, fair enough.
Okay. All right. This is our favorite part of the show. We're going to get to our sponsor break, and with it, Mina's mailbox. We're going to send a note down to Mr. Peter Lorre before he gets started. Oh, Pierre, run this down to him, will you? Thanks. And you're going to hear from Peter Lorre talk about The Unknown by director Todd Browning. So enjoy this break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Godzilla and Megalon's themes, the form, and the aesthetic. All right. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. And Mina's Mailbox is brought to you by Patreon. Become a patron and your comments are tops. Max, we have a comment here from Abogado John on our YouTube page. This is from our Cat People episode, which was released back in June. And Abogado John says, "Damn it, not a movie, just chatter."
He was looking for free movies on YouTube,
which is fair. But if you see Camp Kaiju, if you see an episode of ours on YouTube, it's just going to be audio. It's just going to be this podcast. But the episode for Cat People ran 1 minute and sorry, 1 hour and 10 minutes. So if I'm looking for Cat People from the 40s and I see that runtime, I'm also going to think, yeah, that's probably the movie.
That's true. Yeah. I see your games trying to trick people.
Yeah. So... You know, we're not trying to trick anybody. It's just a podcast. So, Abogado John, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. But I don't get that impression. Well, we will read more next time. Please send us your own thoughts, questions, comments, any grievances you have with Camp Kaiju. Let us know. And we'll feature those comments on the show.
Before Karloff and Lugosi stalked the screens, the movies were no less monstrous. These frightful figures lurked in the expressionistic shadows and danced in the macabre moonlight. They laughed, they cried, they fooled the sensibilities of honest,
decent folk in the age of silent pictures. These gruesome ghouls nonetheless cried out with a savage humanity that took the breath from all those who witnessed the devilish delights. For in the silence, no one can hear you scream. Or, if you are me in this infernal podcast, I am Peter Lorre. You may know me from such movies as The Raven and Arsenic and Old Lace. And you may be wondering how on God's green earth you are hearing my handsome voice when I have been dead these 60 years. Well. Let me tell you about a couple of rat bastards named Matthew and Vincent who have unilaterally decided I would be the perfect host for this segment. I'm flattered, but outraged. The sooner I fulfill my audio obligations, the sooner I may return to the afterlife. So, welcome to Silent But Deadly. This week we discuss... Oh, what is this? Oh, how thoughtful. Thank you, Pierre. Ladies and gentlemen, I've just been visited by my only friend I have in this insufferable recording booth in which I live out the pangs of my resurrection. He has given me a note from my tormentors that reads, Silent But Deadly is brought to you by the mysterious old Radio Listening Society, a podcast dedicated to suspense, crime and horror stories from the golden age of radio. How nice. Another sponsor. Will no one save me? This week, we discuss another Todd Browning picture called The Unknown from 1927. This movie stars the man of a thousand faces, Lon Chaney, in a trademark story of physical deformity. Chaney plays Alonzo the Armless, a circus performer without arms who falls in love with Nenon, played by Joan Crawford, who has an aversion to the physical touch of men. The plot thickens when it is revealed that Alonzo does indeed have his arms and is a murderer on the lam, and if that weren't enough, he has killed Nenon's father. The only clue tying Alonzo to the murder is his double thumb, which has left its telltale print on the dead man's neck. In a fix, Alonzo has his limbs actually amputated before Nenon can learn the truth, and hoping she may love a man who cannot hold her. Does it work out for Alonzo? Oh, positively not. Nenon overcomes her fear of masculine embrace and falls for the strong man of the troop. Devastated and now without arms, Alonzo meets his tragic end. The Unknown was a weaning collaboration between Browning and Chaney, with both men playing to their strengths. The Unknown foreshadows themes of the outcast scene in Browning's 1932 film Freaks, and Chaney delivers another memorable portrayal of a sympathetic villain. Perhaps, however, it is Joan Crawford who delivers the most poignant performance. We are only left with our own perceptions as to the nature of her dramatic relationship with men. Overall, The Unknown is a far less famous movie than other Browning and Chaney pictures, but it is indeed worthy of our attention. Next time on Silent But Deadly, we will discuss another Lon Chaney movie called He Who Gets Slapped. I'm about to slap a baby if this segment goes on much longer. Oh, Pierre, hello. Perhaps you might send a note to the outside world.
If it had a mind, you could reason with it. If it had a body, you could shoot it. If it had a heart, you could kill it. Now, man is no longer the supreme being on this planet.
The organism is growing at a geometric rate. By all accounts, it's at least 1,000 times its original mass.
Nobody believes me about what happened tonight.
What did happen?
You were there, you saw.
Plasmic life form that hunts its prey. Predator.
I want that organism alive.
I think you ticked it off.
Terror has no shape.
Now, let's talk about the themes. This is what the movie is known for. It's deep thematic analysis. But, you know, go for it. What do we got?
The big thing that every Godzilla movie has is its anti-nuclear messaging.
Does it work for you in this movie?
It starts, it's pretty strong actually with it at the very beginning. I mean, the whole premise is that this underwater, underground civilization, Seatopia, became unearthed by nuclear testing in the Aleutian Islands. And then they, the characters have a little bit back and forth of how could the Americans do this? Kind of like, what's the world coming to sort of talk. And then it's just forgotten about.
It's a little, it seems a little obligatory.
Yeah, like it was just, all right, we have these five things we have to include in every Godzilla movie. Where do we fit it in?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is the Seatopians, you know, they actually, after I finished the movie, realized they're not a conquering force like a lot of like alien beings in Godzilla movies. They're just simply defending their homeland, which I found really interesting. Again, the movie doesn't actually care about exploring that, but
no,
you could imagine a version of this movie takes itself maybe a little more seriously and it explores Antonio and like what's Seatopia actually all about and why.
Right.
Why they might be justified in sending Megalon to the surface world.
Well, I mean, Emperor Antonio, in one of his speeches, he goes into how these humans are doing this for the last time. Like, I'm not going to stand here and let them destroy the planet. So it's almost like the trend of, it's like, you know, in Die Hard, the terrorists are environmentalists.
Yeah, well, I think that was also big in the 70s.
Right. So when you read the back of, like, the synopsis from the back of the VHS, it was like, oh, you got these supervillains. Are they supervillains? Not really. They're just a differing perspective. They're not destroying out of necessarily malice. They're just trying to probably save the Earth. But again, much like the nuclear messaging, it kind of only appears in that one bit of dialogue and then doesn't really come up again.
Right. And I'm like, oh, kind of a missed opportunity.
Right. Wouldn't it be awesome if you could actually connect with Emperor Antonio?
It would be. I mean, I think the most interesting and compelling villains are those you can sympathize with. It's the Magneto effect.
Right. So, you know, if they had like a full production cycle for this movie and it was maybe the 80s where they're putting more of a budget towards Godzilla movies, this could have probably been like one of the better Godzilla films with its initial concept.
Yeah. It's due for a remake.
Well, maybe not a remake, but a sequel. Sure.
Yeah.
Or a return to Seatopia.
The Seatopians are still there. Like, nobody, everyone survived.
Yeah, they weren't destroyed. So,
great.
Yeah, let's bring back Emperor Antonio.
Well, speaking of Antonio, what do you think of? So, in this is a very now interpretation of the film, maybe tongue in cheek, but also not. I do want to give reverence to, you know, the LGBT community. In what I have read in various blogs, have latched onto this film for a queer reading that I think is there. I don't think it's not there with some of the characters.
Did you come
across any of that? Like even while watching the movie, did any of that cross your mind?
So the opening scene is Goro and Jinkawa just having a lakeside picnic.
Totally innocent. Nothing going on there.
Nothing going on. But immediately, my wife was like, are they a couple?
Oh, Emily watched it with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Okay, and cool. I love this. Keep going.
It was like an immediate interpretation of what's going on. Because, again, the movie doesn't explore this, like what their relationship is.
Right.
And even then, oh, they're friends. I mean, yeah, a lot of gay characters are just friends
in right, old and because, media. And because the movie doesn't give us any details, it's completely left to our own interpretation. But when you think about, like, I'll post the link to this really great blog from an LGBTQ reviewer. But she points out Jinkawa doesn't go anywhere. Like, he doesn't have a family. He doesn't have a home. He's always there. He's always with Goro. He supposedly lives in this place too. So,
and that I think it's a totally valid interpretation of this movie. Now, whether it's intentional or, you know, there's no budget for the movie, so there's just no other people at all.
No women to cast in this film. No women auditioned, apparently.
Oh.
That's not true. I'm sure women auditioned.
There probably wasn't an audition process. It was like, who do we got for this 3 weeks?
We have all these women. You know, we'll just cast you as Seatopian dancers.
But I still think it's a valid interpretation because. So, yeah, you said there are no women in the film, but there are. So they could have had some actresses in there.
Yeah.
Like any other Godzilla movie. So it could have been an intentional choice. Either way, that reading of the film is there. It's valid. Can't deny it.
You can't deny it. And because that you don't know that Rokuro is Goro's younger brother until halfway through, I'm left thinking, like, what are they, parent figures? Is this an adopted boy? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, well, even if it is a younger brother, it doesn't mean they can't be parental figures.
Oh, I agree. They still are.
Right. And I mean, what further goes into that is, like, Jinkawa, as you said, doesn't have a life in this movie outside of the two brothers.
Oh, and this was...
He doesn't have a home. For all intents and purposes, they're all just living together.
Right. And this is another bit of evidence in support of this reading, too, that I realized Goro and Jinkawa create life through Jet Jaguar, which is the same template as Bride of Frankenstein, where you have Henry and Ernest Thesiger's character, Dr. Pretorius.
Mm-hmm.
And the queer reading of that film is there. Like, that's not up for debate. So, I don't know. Is Godzilla versus Megalon the poor man's Bride of Frankenstein? Maybe.
I think if you just watch this without knowing how limited production resources were, 100%. if you knew the production backstory, then you could probably think of some other reasons. But again, they still made choices to make the movie the way it is and could have easily not made those choices.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm sold.
Totally. Yeah, I agree with that reading. And I think it's, I don't know, it's a really interesting fold to this movie and where it stands within the history of Godzilla.
Yeah.
Makes it worth talking about a little bit. All right, some form and aesthetics.
I will say one thing I latched onto was the music. Now, is the music the same in the Japanese audio?
Ooh, I don't know.
Okay. I know sometimes it can be different.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of jazz flute, which I am not saying is a bad thing. It added energy and life to scenes that didn't really have a whole lot going on visually.
Well, see, that's interesting because in my viewing, I liked the score, but I didn't get enough score. I didn't get it to enhance any of the storytelling or like really at all. I don't know. It just kind of fell and faded to the background.
Oh, I mean, it really added a lot to that car chase.
Right. Like in moments, I think it's really effective.
The Jet Jaguar theme is great.
That's a classic.
And again, it feels like this was already a pre-established character that's like making a guest appearance.
Right, right.
It's like, this is a Godzilla movie, right? Why is Jet Jaguar's theme so prominent throughout it?
Well, so it's a longstanding rumor that's not actually true in terms of evidence. But the rumor is that this was actually a Jet Jaguar movie and they tacked Godzilla on at the end. And it does feel that way.
It does. It does. Yeah.
Godzilla doesn't have as much screen time as Jet Jaguar. And Godzilla is really only saved for the final third of the movie, I would say. But there's no evidence in the production notes that that was originally the case.
I will say I just assumed every special effects shot that didn't have one of the characters in the movie in it was reused footage.
Yes.
Like with Megalon destroying the city.
Yes. That was intercut with King Ghidorah's destruction of the city from Ghidorah, the three-headed monster.
So I don't want to talk too much about that stuff, but the dam sequence was fun.
Oh, yeah. That is a noted standout in this film.
Mm-hmm. Although there is a moment where Megalon kind of gets like rushed through the dam.
Yes.
With the water. And it's just like,
ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of breaks the illusion where it's like, that's just a guy flopping around in a suit.
Uh-huh.
And I got that thought a whole lot during the final fight as well, where they're just kind of rolling around on the ground fighting. It's just like the fight choreography could have been a little better.
Ooh, all right. I mean, I'm not saying that it couldn't have been, but I have a lot to say about that fight.
Well, they just kept cutting back to that.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, we could probably cut 5 minutes out of this fight if we just cut her out the rolling around on the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that just enhances that camp factor in my mind of, yeah, just that total whoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very campy. So we can go ahead to our breakdowns, because I think what I'm going to talk about with the direction and stuff are just some notes that I can just talk about within my own breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the good, the bad, and the campy. Now, my good for this film, I do like Fukuda's direction. My main thing with this film is that it is super low budget, and yet I can see Fukuda doing as much as he can to overcome those limits, along with his cinematographer. So, for example, the kaiju are standing in an open field. That's very difficult in terms of conveying kaiju scale, because if you have a building, you could see how tall that monster is. But if it's just three monsters standing in a field, you lose that weight. However, Fukuda's shooting these moments, he uses a lot of wide angle lenses. Is that it? Just wide frame. He shoots
just them wide shots. Yeah.
Wide shots. Thank you. And he's shooting a lot of them from below, which is like those two ways are like his, I see those as his attempt to still convey some sort of scale.
Yes. He does the same for the human character standing on the, what we're supposed to take as the top of a mountain.
Yeah.
He's shooting them from below just to try to add some sort of scale that isn't really there.
Mm-hmm. My second example of that is the stock footage. This Ghidorah footage of the lightning bolts hitting the building. I think they're intercut well because, well, Megalon has the ability to shoot a beam very much like Ghidorah's. So I'm like, okay, so there was a choice there to say, you know, we're going to use Ghidorah's footage. How can we make Megalon as like Ghidorah as possible? So I'm like, okay, well, I think you pulled it off then.
Oh, yeah. It was never a situation while watching the movie of that's definitely older footage. Like right. If I watch this again with no knowledge of the production history, I wouldn't even think of it.
Exactly. And I didn't either until, well, I've just seen every Godzilla movie now. So now I can recognize footage from other movies. But if you don't know, you don't know. You don't know and you don't notice it. And I think that's a strength of the stock footage. So what do you like about this movie?
Well, I mentioned the music. I really liked that the final fight was a tag team match, like a professional wrestling sort of vibe.
Yeah.
There's camaraderie on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I like the intentional choice of, I don't know, making them much more human in their responses. I mean, Jet Jaguar is humanoid robot. So it's just his thumbs up. Godzilla, when he enters the fight arena, his like arms are up.
Oh my gosh.
He's got a grand entrance, like he's walking into the ring.
Yep.
I loved it. I loved everything about it.
It tells a story.
Yes.
There's moments where the heroes are, you think they're down and out. They got the fire ring around them.
Mm-hmm.
They're really struggling. But then the tables turn and yeah, it's done really well.
They start working together, like getting comfortable, you know, communicating better. And so that's to counter the criticism I gave of the fight choreography and then just rolling around on the ground because there is more of the good that I just mentioned than the rolling around on the ground. And it, again, you cut like a little bit of the rolling around out and I think it'd be a much tighter, more fun fight sequence.
Yeah. Onto the bad. This is funny for me because I don't think this movie as a bad movie, but just like a really campy movie. I think its weaknesses in a weird way enhance the enjoyment of the film. But I will say that the script is it's again very surface level. That you don't know any backstory, you don't know anything, which could enhance the, you know, your enjoyment of the film, depending on what you're looking for in a Godzilla movie. More importantly for me, I do miss cityscapes, cities being destroyed, model cities in these later Godzilla movies from the Showa era. And I do find the visual palette of this film rather bland and visually uninteresting.
Well, the lack of backstory that is not there for the characters and everything. I mean, yeah, I could have come up with a whole bunch of stuff myself, but in reality, mixed in with what you were saying, like the blandness, it was just boring in some parts.
Yeah.
Like I just wasn't invested, which, you know, there's a lot of Godzilla movies that follow that same trajectory, but I'm not going to lie. I did doze for like a minute at some point.
Yeah.
But
and this is an hour and a half film, less than. And the fact that it has some slow moments is
it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
But it did, you know, I dozed for about a minute, woke up just in time for the final fight. So I was all rested and perfectly back in. So that's kind of a bad that turns into a good. At least has a silver lining.
Yeah, yeah. So what other things didn't work for you with this movie?
Well, one big thing that I guess you can call it bad, but maybe this falls more into the campy, because I've given a fair amount of criticism, so I don't want to like retread all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just go straight to the campy.
Okay, great.
Which is all the very obvious wire holding things up.
Yeah, and go on, and then I'll add to that.
And with this also, like, the stiffness in flying,
mm-hmm.
which this isn't a criticism of only this movie, or really a criticism. It's just a style of a lot of the Japanese media in this genre. They were all doing similar stuff. So it has now become a trope, and therefore is fully camp at this point.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't look at it and be like, oh, I can see that wire. Why isn't Megalon moving while he's drilling through the earth or flying? It was more just, oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
Oh, one other thing that it's not necessarily campy. It was just really fun to watch. I forgot that Megalon moves around on land by hopping.
Oh my God. I was like, what is he doing?
Maybe it was because he's very bug-like and they're like, well, you know, bugs hop.
Yeah.
But it was fun. And he's got three different modes of transportation. He like flies, he hops, he drills.
I love the character design of Megalon a lot.
Yeah, we didn't even get into all that. And that much kudos to the design team, because it was fun. I like his design. I wish he was in more things.
Agreed. So along those lines, so what I wanted to say was because we watched this Criterion Blu-ray high def. And I wonder if we don't see the wires as much in an old beat up tape version of this film. You know what I mean?
Maybe. But you also have to remember this wasn't shown in theaters on a VHS copy.
But it also wasn't shown in the kind of high def that we have today.
Correct. But from my experience, when Criterion does their like Blu-ray copies, they're not bringing an over quality that diminishes the work.
Okay.
One notable terrible example is, you know, the Back to the Future Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Where you can see all the like old makeup and things.
Yeah, like that. I know. Yeah.
I haven't noticed anything like that watching Criterion Blu-rays. So I don't know if that's just me giving them too much credit, or if they're intentionally keeping it lower or what have you. But I don't think it's because it's a Blu-ray that we're seeing all this stuff.
Okay.
Like, I would imagine seeing the zippers and costumes.
Right.
Which you can kind of see some of the seams with Gigan's costume. But I think that's more the costume design that they went with and not the quality we're watching it in.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Well, the only way to know is to watch my VHS copy, and I'll let you know.
That's true.
So my campy is related to this fight. This is like the fight has such great moments of storytelling, little moments. Godzilla's knocked down. He's on the ground. Megalon shoots one of his napalm bombs out of his mouth. And this little ball, you can think of it as a grenade.
I love that.
It rolls towards Godzilla's face. And before it can explode, Jet Jaguar like essentially dives on the grenade, picks it up, and chucks it back at Megalon. And I was like, this is awesome. This is what I want.
I did note that moment as well. And another thing I thought about it was, why is this suddenly like a rolling grenade and not just immediately exploding on impact like every other time in the movie? But I'm glad it did that because it is a fun little scene.
You can picture Jet Jaguar yelling, "Grenade!"
Right. It does add to their camaraderie, and like you feel like they're a team, real team by the end.
Right.
So
another wonderful moment is Jet Jaguar is now down for the count, and he's kind of buried up to his neck, and Gigan goes up behind him and like threatens to cut his throat if Godzilla comes any closer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that, just a little moment. It's adding to character. It's adding to the tag team wrestling, you know, melodrama of it all. You're just like, what?
Yep. Yep.
Gigan and Megalon are a good pair.
Yeah. They feel like they're cartoon bad guys.
Yeah. And they act all conniving and mean. They're like, they're like schoolyard bullies.
Yeah. It's like a combination of schoolyard bully and mustache twirling villain.
Yep. It's great.
And I think visually they work well together.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was a good choice to bring Gigan back for this.
Yeah.
This team up.
Yeah. All right. That's all, folks. The last bit we have, we got to give it a rating. Does this movie stand the test of time? We have four ratings on Camp Kaiju. We'll start from the bottom and go to the top. So we have, it's not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time. It may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. We have, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and it stands the test of time. For our final rating, it is a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Max, where do you fall with Godzilla versus Megalon?
I'm going to say it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. And that's because you're laughing.
Sorry, I mean, I don't mean to be surprised, shocked, and awed.
Well, I say this because watching the movie now is completely different from watching it when it was first released. It has been given a new life the longer we are from its original release and what original criticisms of the movie were. Because if you watch this movie in a vacuum, it's just a fun, campy movie. You put it on, it might lose your attention for a little bit, but there's always something that brings you back after a few minutes, whether it's Megalon destroying the dam or the city, or just you look up and suddenly you're in Seatopia and you're like, what is going on right now? Or that final fight. So I think there was probably a time period where this was like at the very bottom and not worth revisiting. But now, looking back, if someone were to watch it, let's say they're watching all of the Godzilla movies and this just happened to be the first one they watch, they're going to enjoy it.
That's awesome. I love all that. I think all you have said is very legitimate. However, I will say there are some antiquated moments in terms of character, human characters, and the budget being so bare bones. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more effort put into having some extras around, having some more Seatopia, I don't need more Robert. Well, see, this is the point. It can't be fun because some people would say more Robert Dunham would be a terrible choice. I say more Robert Dunham would be an excellent choice.
I would love to see him like riding Megalon.
Yes, something. Did you notice his tiara has Megalon's head on it?
I did. That was great. That was a nice little touch.
Thank you, costume department, for coming up with that choice.
And they didn't have to do that.
No, but it's so good.
That's what I'm saying. Timeless classic.
Well, I agree. It is a classic, and it does stand. It does stand the test of time. It is an overall great example of the kind of camp Godzilla can represent.
Yes, I would definitely watch this first, though, before any other ones, so you don't recognize the stock footage.
Right. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, next time on Camp Kaiju, we will welcome Matt back to the show for Arachnophobia. So that'll be coming at you next Saturday. Quick turnaround there. And then we will see Max back here for The Mummy, 1999's The Mummy, and more trivia. Naomi will be joining us as well. Matt Levine, gang's all back. We're going to get the band back together here. So stay tuned for your chance to win some Camp Kaiju merchandise. And let us know what you thought about this episode, what you think about Emperor Antonio, and anything else we talked about. So thank you, Max. Appreciate having you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So thanks for hanging out, friends. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com, our Facebook page, or on Instagram. Links in the bio. Or hey, if you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612. And please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more information. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Mina's Mailbox, music by Ben Cook Veltz. Thanks, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder at the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio.
ロボットだけどジェットジャガーやったでジャガー行け行け平和を守るためみんなも驚く勇気を見せるゴジラとジャガーでパンチパンチパンチ泣くな僕らも頑張る